Today we take up an overall survey of Savitri, which may easily be considered to be the final testament of Sri Aurobindo to humanity. It contains the essence of his vision, his experience, and his mission. As you all know, he started working upon this poem even when he was in Baroda. And for over 50 years, he was working upon it. Naturally, it has undergone a number of revisions, drafts, and Dinendra Kumar Roy, the Bengali literator, mentions in his memoirs that Sri Aurobindo was writing on Savitri during the Baroda period. At that time, he had given the title A Tale and a Vision. Obviously, when he was acquainting himself with the Indian lore, particularly the epics, he must have come across in detail the story of Savitri. Now, the story of Savitri originally appears in the Mahabharata, in the Vanaparva. It runs into four cantos and has been repeated with some modifications or other in the various Puranas. And today, there is not a single Indian Hindu family who is not conversant with the main story of Savitri. The story as it runs is this. Ashwapati, king of the kingdom of Madra, he had no issues. And as was the custom during those times, he goes to the forest for austerities to propitiate the goddess, and he is there in the forest for nearly 18 years undergoing penance, austerities, at the end of which period goddess Savitri appears to him and grants him a boon that something of her would take birth as his daughter. Satisfied, the king returns to his kingdom, and in due course, a resplendent daughter is born. The daughter is brought up in a royal way, and when the time comes for the princess to marry, to choose her suitor, it was found that nobody would come to claim her hand. Though everybody would admire, nobody would come to claim. So, having waited enough, the king asks her to go abroad, go around the world and choose her own partner. So the princess, accompanied by an aged minister and a retinue, she starts out. And it is more than 2 years since she makes up her choice and returns to her father to announce her choice that she has selected Satyavan, son of an exiled king, Dyumatsena. Sage Narad, who happens to be there very conveniently, he disapproves and says, but Satyavan is going to die within a year. And she is advised to change, but she says, no, I have given my word, and once I have decided, there is no question of changing. So, the parents yield, she is married to Satyavan, and 1 year passes, and on the fated day, she accompanies Satyavan to the forest on the plea of wanting to get herself acquainted with the region frequented by her husband. And when he is cutting wood for fuel in the forest, Yama appears, the god of death, and claims his soul. She tries to argue with him, to stop him, but for no avail, he pulls out his soul. And then he starts going back to his kingdom. But Savitri would not leave him. She has in the meanwhile equipped herself with religious rituals, and she follows Yama, the god of death. He is certain that at some stage when they reach the river Vaitarini, which cannot be crossed by humans, she is bound to stop. But to his amazement, because of the virtue that she has gained by reason of his austerities, she crosses the river, follows him, and to a wonderstruck Yama, she is irresistible in her arguments, in her religious power of character, and he gives her plenty of boons, returns her husband, and all is well. Now this story is told and repeated, read out in many homes to emphasize the virtue of conjugal fidelity, happiness. To Sri Aurobindo, however, his eye perceived something more, something behind the whole story. He saw some memory, some recollection of an event that must have happened in the early cycles of the Aryan people. And why he felt like that, he explains. The names of the characters, they gave him a clue. Satyavan is one who carries satya, one who carries the truth, the soul, the human soul which carries the truth, that is Satyavan. Then his father, and Savitri, she is the daughter of the sun, Savitri. the divine word, the grace that has come down to deliver man from the grip of death. And her father, Ashwapati, his name is more symbolic. Ashwa, right from the Vedic days, has come to signify power, spiritual power, vital power. And he is the Pati, he is the Lord of spiritual power. Only one who has obtained mastery over the spiritual power can father the human embodiment of divine grace. That is Ashwapati. Then comes the father of Satyavan. He is Dyumatsena. Dyumatsena, Dyumat is shining. Sena is host, army. So Lord of the shining hosts, Dyumatsena. It means the divine mind, lustrous, which is now blinded. He is a blinded king, blinded, exiled from his rightful kingdom of light, and descended into this world of ignorance and blindness, falsehood. That is why he is exiled, he is blinded, and he is outcast. That is the divine mind. So these names gave him a clue that it is not just a story. It is not only a legend, but it signifies something else in the evolution of humanity, a promise. And so he called it a symbol. He turned the whole story into a narrative, a prophecy of the conquest of death by the divine grace for the benefit of humanity as part of the manifestation of truth. And in doing so, choosing this noble theme, he converted a local legend into a symbol of cosmic significance. It is not that it is a poetic vision. It is a prophetic grasp of something to happen, which is in the process of happening. That is why so much importance is given. It is not a vision of a utopian character, but because there is a truth content in it, and it is developing in the evolution of humanity, that it has come to occupy such a prominent position in the writings of Sri Aurobindo. As I said, he worked over it for nearly half a century. As you all know, he was a perfectionist. Even his prose writings, like Life Divine, before it was given the last touch, he would revise and revise, change even a comma, take it back, put it back, and till the last moment he would see the proofs, as long as his eyesight was in order. He would always go through the proofs and make corrections. If that he did that in prose, you can imagine what he did in poetry. He was a born poet, and he was proud of it. When Radha Krishna addressed him as a philosopher, when he wanted a contribution from him for the Silver Jubilee volume of the Indian Philosophical Congress, he wrote to Dilip that, "I have never been a philosopher. I was a poet and a politician." So this being a poet, his conception of poetry was different from the modern or the normal conception of poetry as it goes. He always had that Vedic context, Vedic background, that a poetry is not just meant to amuse. It is meant not only to enlighten, but to deliver. Deliver a charge of inspiration which the poet receives. Poetry is a charged word, and in his study entitled "The Future Poetry," he traces the development of English poetry and shows how it is steadily moving in the direction of the mantric concept, the word as a mantra. Of course, he did not have to dwell upon it as far as Sanskrit poetry is concerned, because it is always an accepted fact. And as it has turned out to be, Savitri has been a perfect example of the mantric poetry that he had always envisaged. Apart from the fact that it is the longest epic in the English language, something a little less than 24,000 lines, though Mother was pretty certain that it must have been 24,000 lines. Somehow some lines have been missing, and some portions have been revised at least 11 times. Some, I was told, 21 times. I am not sure, but of 11 times I am quite sure. And he did not have as much time as he wanted to write it. He would take it up for a while, then other preoccupations would intervene, and then it would be dropped to be taken up sometime again. Also, apart from the question of time, he used Savitri, writing Savitri, as an experiment in expressing the different states of consciousness which he was ascending in the course of his yoga. So he said, "I revise each portion that I write. I would pull up to the new level of consciousness attained when I took it up again for revision." So each portion, important portion at least, has been pulled up number of times, and there are so many drafts. Ultimately, he revised the last portions of his choice only a few weeks before he left his body. He worked furiously on the Book of Fate, in which he dwells upon many fundamental issues before man. Before that, he did the 11th book, containing only one canto, The Everlasting Day, of about 1500 lines, out of which at least 400 lines were dictated at one stretch perhaps a little less than 400, but we can say 400 lines. And what is remarkable is that of the 1500 lines that he dictated, not a comma had to be changed afterwards. It is in such white heat of inspiration that he has cast his whole philosophy, knowledge, experience in the lines of Savitri. Also, as Mother confirmed later, her own yogic experience alongside his, they have been verbally recorded in some of the portions of this poem. It is an epic. It is not just a poem. And an epic by standards, all standards, is something that sums up in itself the high peaks of human civilization, of the people concerned, the contemporary thoughts and customs, ways of living, and the ideal held up by them. So the past, the present, and the future. Sri Aurobindo has given remarkable expressions, has used remarkable expressions, reflecting the contemporary mood and the idiom. He speaks, for instance, of the stratosphere of the superconscient, of unprovisioned checks on the beyond, on the credit bank of time. He speaks of the cold fifth columnist, an expression, fifth columnist, which came into prominence and usage during the Spanish Civil War. He speaks of television's glass, many of these expressions expressing the technical bent of the human mind in the present times. He sums up the past, how the world began, at what stage the humanity of the day came to be, and what is most important, which no other work has given with that accuracy that it has, Savitri has, is the geography of the occult worlds. The whole of the second book, spread over 200 pages and more, he describes the different worlds, the layers of the levels of worlds, right from the earth to the Satchidananda, physical earth to the Satchidananda, with great detail. How there are different worlds in broadly in seven categories, and how each world is interacting with others, and what it means to man on earth. This, no writer, no theologian has given in this detail. There have been some writers, Swedenborg, for instance, who has written about the hell and heaven and all these, but they are more or less colored by their Christian beliefs, and they are not verifiable. What Sri Aurobindo has written and described in the book of the Traveler of the Worlds, they can be verified. There are scriptures in the different parts of the world, which confirm the existence of these worlds, the character of these worlds, the denizens of those worlds. That he has done with great detail, at times almost frightening, at times unnerving, but he has done with great beauty and great precision. The rest, he has caught up the story, added number of his own observations, and altogether introduced a new style. For instance, in one line, he would narrate, he would sum up a whole experience, and then it would be followed by four or five lines of explaining things. In another place, he would first develop a thought, five lines, six lines, and then on the seventh, he would sum up the entire thought. So there is a lot of variety in dealing, and there are a lot of echoes from the other scriptures, other religious writings, incidents that have happened in the growth of man. And there is much more which we would touch when, as we get along. Now, we said that Savitri is both a legend and a symbol. Now, in the very first canto, these two are juxtaposed. So the beginning of the canto, first canto, the symbol dawn, is both the first dawn of the present cycle of manifestation. It is also the dawn of the day when Satyavan must die. So on one level, it narrates the events preceding the this cycle of manifestation. Somewhere in the middle, he joins it to the morning when Savitri wakes up and remembers that that is the day when Satyavan must die. So both are combined in a very skillful way. And everybody would agree that this first canto is the most difficult to understand and much more difficult to expound. But on that account, we shall not skip it. And he begins with the line, "It was the hour before the gods awake." That is, the gods, the cosmic functionaries, are not yet started their work. He does not say they were asleep, because gods do not sleep. Aswapnaha deva. The gods do not wink their eyes. They are always open. So he says, before the gods awake, means awaken to activity. And that is the time before anything starts. And then he gives a series of descriptions, a series of pictures of what was there before this creation, before this manifestation, before this light. What was there? He says, there was only the night. Night means the dark in conscience. Before consciousness can come, before any life can manifest, there is something inconscient, without life, without consciousness. There was nothing. But you can't simply say that it was empty. So there was the foreboding mind of night lay stretched across the marge of silence. I'm not sure if the line is correct. Yes. The foreboding mind of night lay stretched immobile upon silence marge. That is, there was utmost silence. There was no movement, no sound. And on the border of that silence, this mind of night, inconscious, alone, there was nothing else, lay stretched, it was spread out. And to hint that it is not something dead, Sri Aurobindo deliberately uses, in her unlit temple of eternity. He says the word temple is to convey the sense that there is something holy, something sacred. Even in the inconscient, there is the divine presence. Temple of eternity. Time is not it. It is only the eternal. And that is the temple. The eternal is itself a temple. And that mind is a foreboding mind. There is something which indicates that something is to come. It points to something that is to happen. That mind. And it lay stretched immobile. And what did it feel? This foreboding mind of night stretched out says it is something like the abysm, the profound depth of the infinite, which has yet no form, no body. Something like an abyss, and the mind was a muse, musing, dwelling upon something, but it had no sight, it had no eye. So this is a very memorable description, which he ends saying at that time. A fathomless zero occupied the world. Zero means apparently there is nothing, but it is not an empty zero, it is a fathomless. You can't plumb and find out thus far, this is the foundation. No, a fathomless zero occupied the world. Everything comes out of that zero. So first, the foreboding mind of the gods have not got into activity. There is the night of inconscience, and the foreboding, that mind of night, is stretched out. It is signifying something foreboding, and one feels a giant fathomless zero occupying everything. We'll go ahead with the next picture in our next session. Recollect what we were speaking. We are on the eve of a new cycle of creation. It is understood that this manifestation is not launched once for all. It proceeds through a series of cycles, what are called yugas in the Indian terminology. So a cycle has ended and a new cycle is about to begin. We are on the eve of a new dawn. But across this event of dawn, there is stretched across the future event a mind, a foreboding mind of night. It is the mind of inconscience, dark inconscience, that is lying stretched out, barring the way as it were. And this mind, which is a power of a boundless self that had fallen at the end of the earlier cycle, recalls all that happened. It is between the two nothingnesses, the inconscient at one end and the superconscient at the other. In between is this self that has fallen, and the mind of that self recalls from where it has come and also remembers how it is faced with the insoluble mystery of birth. Why this birth? For what purpose? And it also remembers the long process of life and death it has gone through, and it wishes now to end itself in nothingness. That is one. Second, here Sri Aurobindo develops a number of images. What was happening at that time? First the mind of night, then the mind as a power of that night, a power of that boundless self from the old cycle which has fallen, remembering all the tardy process of mortality and wanting to end itself in nothingness. The third image is something unknown is repeating some action, some throb, mechanical movement. And that mechanical movement, repeating itself again and again, is a kind of a cradle for the drowse, the sleepy condition of the cosmic force. It is a kind of in a sleepy mood. But this slumber, this kind of sleep of the cosmic force is so potent that it goes on to kindle the suns, the center of light, and it carries our lives in its somnambulist whirl. The cosmic force in its tranced condition is moving, and in that very rapid movement the sun is kindled, the source of light. The next imagery is in that state of tranced space. There is a space spread out, but it is not vibrant. It is in a kind of trance. There is no mind, there is no life, and in that space the earth is wheeling round and round, as if abandoned in the hollow gulfs. She has forgotten her spirit and her fate. Why she is there, where she is wheeling now. If the earth is wheeling round in the somnambulist whirl, in the trance of space, the skies above are neutral. Can't say they are bright, can't say they are dark. They are empty. There is no sun, there is no cloud, and they are still. We don't hear any wind or air rippling in the sky. And in this background of earth wheeling round and round, the skies being impassive and still, something in that darkness of night, which cannot be analyzed, which cannot be fathomed, it stirs. There is a what is called spanda in Sanskrit, and a movement for which you can have no name, which can have no name, an idea which is not thought over. Appears, and it looks as if this idea, this movement, has no aim, but it wants something, but it does not know how to do that, and that stir teases this the inconscient to wake ignorance. This is a very famous expression of Sri Aurobindo, a criticism of which leads him to write a defense, a classic defense of his stand as a poet. Because the critics who hold that in bringing the inconscient and the ignorance, he is bringing in philosophy. Philosophy in poetry, which is not done. Poetry is an art. You can't bring metaphysics, you can't bring philosophy in poetry. So that is a school of thought of critics, which voiced its criticism of this kind of poetry. 主アロビンドホベは says that he does not accept the position that a poet has only to weave beautiful pictures, descriptions of nature and things like that. But he says it is quite legitimate for a poet to render his vision, to describe his experience. Come, it reveals, it shows, and that is the adoration of nature, of the goddess of dawn. We'll continue next time.